Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. The latest on health and healing, a special commentary on the future. I'll add in my own commentary at the same time, and we'll be learning from Professor Nozomi Hazy, a former WikiLeaks Central contributing writer who's been covering issues of freedom of speech, transparency, and decentralized movements. So that'll be interesting to hear what she has to say, and I'll add in some things as well. Also today, I want you to hear from Jordan Peterson. He's a controversial educator and a psychologist, a philosopher, but he's at Harvard giving a lecture. He used to teach at Harvard, teaches at the university now. And for all the millennials, I think you'll appreciate some of what he has to say. For those of other generations, X and the boomers, it's particularly revealing. You can agree or disagree with part or whole, but we need to start stimulating our thought by getting away from our almost embryonic, interwoven beliefs that nothing can penetrate those beliefs, so we stay the same. Also today, I have a guest in the second part of our program. She is one of the best experts in the world on the truth of what's happening in the Middle East, Vanessa Bealey. She'll be speaking with us from Paris on conditions in Syria and American and Israeli attacks on Assad's forces. She's the one who first exposed the fraud of the white helmets, where all of Hollywood and the liberal community was praising them and giving them an Academy Award and having them on Democracy Now! She showed that they're terrorists. So she's going to tell us today the truth in the Middle East, because she's there and she's talking firsthand. As you see, we have a lot to share, and we always begin our program with the latest on health and healing. And the first study up today is from Brigham Young University, and it's about exercise. And why? Because when you're jogging, power walking, or running, it helps your brain stave off the effects of chronic stress. I alluded to something yesterday when I was talking about how wonderful it is to be able to run or work out with people. First, they motivate each other. You'll always do a little better than what you would do on your own, and I think that's important. But also, there's that quiet camaraderie where you're out there, you're putting in your miles, your body's getting into shape, your mind's relaxing, and you're flooding the body with endorphins, feel-good hormones. So it really sets the whole day emotionally for you. But most people agree that getting a little exercise helps when dealing with stress. But this new Brigham Young University study discovers exercise, particularly running, while under stress, also helps protect your memory. The study was newly published in the Journal of Neurobiology of Learning and Memory, finds that running mitigates the negative impacts of chronic stress on the hippocampus. That's the part of the brain responsible for learning and memory. Quote from the study: exercise is a simple and cost-effective way to eliminate the negative impact on memory of chronic stress. And, well, I'll just give you a little deeper understanding of this. Inside the hippocampus, memory formation and recall occur optimally when the synapses or the connections between neurons are strengthened over time. And that process of synaptic strengthening is called long-term potentiation, or LTP. And chronic or prolonged stress weakens the synapses, which decreases the LTP and ultimately impacts memory. The study found that when exercising, you are increasing your capacity to deal with stress and you're remaining more normal. So that's important. Exercise, when you're stressed, it helps you. Exercise, when you're not stressed, it helps prevent the negative effects of a cortisol rush. From Indiana University, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they looked at a meta-analysis and they found that magnesium is really good for lowering your blood pressure. Now, think of it this way. We currently have about 70 million Americans who have post-stable hypertension, meaning they're taking medications. They're able to live a fairly normal life, though there are side effects to those medications. And then when they found that the magnesium is used as a supplement, it has a reduction in systolic and diastolic blood pressure in men and women, especially those who are with insulin resistance or prediabetes. And that is very important. So that is the latest on what we have to know about magnesium. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Always and forever, each moment with you.
We just had a little technical glitch there. Hopefully you're all able to hear the program again. The amount of magnesium that we need, according to these 11 randomized studies, is not that much. You're looking at about 365 milligrams a day, and this was consumed for about 1 to 6 months. I would suggest that you consume approximately 800 milligrams of magnesium. And I suggest you consume 400 in the morning before your workout, because it can help prevent a heart attack, and 400 at night because it can help prevent a heart attack during sleep. Magnesium is your single most important mineral for your heart. Also, everyday activities are associated with more gray matter in the brain as you age. From Rush University College of Nursing, higher levels of lifestyle physical activity, meaning simple things, taking your dog for a walk, a gardening, house cleaning, something that allows you to move your muscles, is associated with more gray matter in the brain, and that means that you're going to slow down the aging of the brain. This was published in the Journal of Gerontology, Physiology, and Sciences. And maybe you're not aware of this. If you are, fine. If not, I always like to keep people up to date. The gray matter in the brain includes regions responsible for controlling muscle movement and experiencing the senses and thinking and feeling and memory and speech and a lot more. So the volume of gray matter is a measure of your brain's health. But the amount of gray matter in the brain often begins to decrease, generally in your 30s. So even before symptoms of cognitive dysfunction appear, this is from the study, more gray matter is associated with better cognitive function, while decreasing in gray matter are associated with Alzheimer's disease and other related dementias, as according to the study. So what we should be doing is learning a new word each day, learning a language, learning to play an instrument or listening to classical music, writing in our journals. All of that helps this process. Also, there is a study about protecting yourself from radiation. One of the things they've suggested is flax seeds. Now, most people don't eat flax seeds, but flaxseed oil is extremely good for you. And there is also a pulverized powder you can get, flaxseed powder. According to Margie King in Green Med Info, we're getting a lot of harmful radiation. In fact, about half of our radiation exposure in the United States comes from medical tests like X-rays or CAT scans. And the balance comes from the radiation in the Earth and radon gas and radiation from space, meaning the more you fly, the more background radiation you're exposed to. And most pilots and flight attendants are not taught that, but they should. So there is a legitimate reason to be concerned about how much radiation your body's exposed to. And according to the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, they found that flaxseed may help protect your lungs against the damage caused by radiation exposure. The researchers believe that flaxseed may also have a role in protecting other healthy tissues and organs before exposure to radiation and significantly reduces damage even after exposure. So flaxseed, I would suggest a tablespoon a day plus a teaspoon of the oils. And one of the reasons is because it's so rich in lignans, L-I-G-N-A-N-S. That's a class of phytoestrogens, which are plant estrogens, that also act as antioxidants. Now, there are other lignan seeds like sesame seeds, sunflower seeds, and pumpkin seeds. That's why I suggest that you have them as snacks. And grains like rye, barley, wheat, and oats, broccoli and beans, and the flaxseed has 800 times the amount of lignans as any other that I just mentioned. In fact, the ancient plant, by the way, flax is also known as linseed, has been a part of human history for over 30,000 years. It used to be used for weaving cloth and feeding people and animals, even making paint. In fact, Hippocrates recommended in 650 BC for people suffering from the pains in the lower regions, including the intestines. And Charlemagne was so taken with the special benefits of flax that in the 8th century, he required by law that his subjects consume it. I found that women who are suffering from any menopausal symptoms can have it improved. It also reduces your risk of breast cancer. Remember this, when eaten, lignans are broken down by bacteria in the gut into what is called two estrogen-like compounds that circulate through the liver. And these compounds have been proven in studies to help prevent breast cancer and colon cancer. And in postmenopausal women, I suggest 25 grams a day of ground flaxseed. That can make a big difference. And so flaxseed is good on all levels. I suggest you use it. And also, a lot of people don't realize you can actually help your bones prevent osteoporosis or brittle bones with broccoli and spinach. That's correct. According to Science Daily, a new study from engineering researchers at Rensselaer Polytech Institute shows for the first time how the little understood protein in the body plays a significant role in the strength of our bones. And this was a National Institute of Health study, and they found that we're not using some of the foods that could help give our bones greater strength. And right up there at the top of the list is broccoli and spinach. So your green vegetables, we already knew kale was good and seaweed was good, but that's also good. And also, for those of you who are interested in sodas, and a lot of people are, I mean, the reality is tens of millions of Americans consume sodas, regular sodas or diet sodas every day. From Boston University School of Public Health, they're saying, be careful, because drinking sodas increase dramatically, but also it can decrease the chance of getting pregnant. For those who want to have pregnancy, you don't want to be drinking any sodas. This was published in the journal Epidemiology. I was asked recently about whitening the teeth, some of those commercials on television. Well, they're not telling you the whole truth. In my opinion, they're giving you only what they want you to know to buy their products. We have stained teeth for a lot of reasons. Smoking cigarettes, drinking tea or coffee, eating a poor diet, thinning of the tooth enamel, suffering from dry mouth. Remember, your saliva protects the enamel. Blocking the nasal passages and breathing through the mouth. Excessive fluoride and antibiotic use. Those are some. So what can you do to get your teeth whiter without harming them, without bleaching them? Probably at the top of my list would be coconut oil pulling, P-U-L-L-I-N-G. Oil pulling is an old remedy, and a lot of people swear by it because it helps to whiten teeth. And coconut oil has a natural antimicrobial property. fact, has many different properties. And it contains lauric acid, L-A-U-R-I-C, that can rid your teeth of bacteria and promote gum health, and also helps your breath as well, keeps you with sweet breath. And the study was published in the Journal of Contemporary Dental Hygiene. So it found that oil pulling is safe, natural, no side effects, and it's effective. Just a teaspoon of coconut oil in your mouth, and then you pull it and swish it. Just swish it around your mouth for about, well, it takes time. You have to get it between your teeth and all for about 5 to 10 minutes. And so that can make a difference. Or you can put a couple drops of coconut oil on your toothbrush. Baking soda is one of the natural, old-fashioned ways of brightening your teeth. Using hydrogen peroxide with baking soda is a great 1-2 combination because it's antibacterial, which is good, and it cleans the gums and the teeth, also good. One of the reasons when we wake up in the morning we should go in and brush our teeth is because lots of bacteria on our tongue, on our teeth, between our teeth, on the gums. So what happens is when you're brushing, you're dislodging the bacteria, then take your mouthwash and swish it around, and then take a tongue cleaner and gently, from the back to the front, take off the bacteria. And that way, when you're eating or drinking, you're not putting that bacteria back into your system. Apple cider vinegar also works. It's a natural antibiotic, and it's great at removing stains on teeth, especially nicotine in coffee. Activated charcoal can also work. Orange and lemon peels work, and turmeric works. Generally, you mix 2 parts turmeric powder, 1 part coconut oil, and 1 part baking soda. It makes a great toothpaste. You then massage that around your gums and teeth for 2 minutes and rinse well. You can also use a banana peel. The skin of a banana contains high levels of potassium, magnesium, and manganese. All of these help remove teeth stains. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. Zeno Radio, that you can call that number and listen, was having a little technical difficulties because we had so many people. We're number one in the world trying to get on. Sometimes, unfortunately, it crashes their system. Here's a remedy. A, if you're not at a computer, then you can look on your cell phone and there is a store. In the store, there is an app. The app is for PRN.FM, and you can use that app, and then you don't have to worry. You'll get, every time, anywhere, you just go to that app, and you can hear the program, and you won't have any problems with it. And a lot of people are using that, by the way. I'm going to do 2 things. I'm going to do a commentary, but before the commentary, I want to play a... not a long clip, but I'm not going to play all of it. But I'm going to play enough for you to get an idea of what it means when really critical thinking professors go against the trend, state things that are politically, they're not politically correct. But that doesn't mean that they're not true. And sometimes we have to get out of our groupthink and our biases and prejudices to really hear what someone is saying. We frequently hear a catchword or phrase, and we immediately react. It's almost limbic. It's important to develop a critical capacity for thinking. That is frequently, not always, but it's frequently lacking in most schools of higher education. Here is a man, he is controversial, Jordan Peterson. He has something to say about education, and he's giving a lecture at Harvard. Please listen in.
You mentioned these ideas of responsibility, of virtue, of respect. You've, I think, detailed what you think students shouldn't do in these examples of like protests and these examples of certain types of activist tactics. What advice would you have for students? How can students make the changes that they want to make? Particularly, do you have any advice for students here?
Yeah, read great books.
Mm-hmm.
Really, man? You've got this four-year period that has been carved out of your lives by society. It's given you an identity, like a high-quality identity, and freedom at the same time. And you're not going to get that again in your life. You've got a respectable identity, university student, and complete freedom associated with that, or as near as you're ever going to get. And you've got these unbelievable libraries that are full of the writings of people mm-hmm. who are intelligent and articulate beyond comprehension. And, you know, and you can go there and you can learn all this. And you might think, well, why should you learn it? You learn it to get a job, or you learn it to get good grades, or you learn it to get a degree. And that's all nonsense. It's nonsense. The reason that you come to university to be educated is because there is nothing more powerful than someone who is articulate and who can think and speak. It's power. And I mean power of the best sort. It's authority and influence and respectability and competence. And so you come to university to craft your highest skill. And your highest skill is to be found in articulated speech. And if you're a master at formulating your arguments, you win everything. And better than that, when you win everything, everyone around you wins too. Because to transform yourself into, let's consider your transformation into something approximating the logos, it means you shine a light on the whole world. Well, there's nothing more exciting to do than that. There's nothing better you can possibly do. And to think that you're coming to university to be, you know, trained to have a job, it's like, great, that's a hell of a lot better than being unemployed and covered with Cheeto dust while you're snacking away in front of your video game in the basement. But it's not and I don't have anything against video games, by the way. But it's hardly a triumphant call to being in the world, and that's what university should be calling forth. It's like, God, you people, I know what Harvard students are like. I taught here for 5 years. You people are spectacular. You're spectacular. You're all capable of being world beaters. You transform yourself into something that's articulated and sensible and grounded in history and knowledgeable and wise, man. You can do anything you want, and hopefully anything you want for good. Because if you have any sense, everything you want to do would be for the good, because there's nothing more compelling or meaningful or useful in combating the tragedy of life than to struggle with all your soul on behalf of the good. And the universities have forgotten that. It's why everyone's bailing out of the humanities, and they should. The humanities are corrupt. And they're corrupt because they're not telling students this. It's so bloody obvious. It's like, learn to think, learn to speak, learn to read. It makes you a superpower, an individual superpower. You have And I don't understand why that isn't just told to students. It's not that hard to understand, and everyone wants to hear it. It's like, really? I could do that? I could do that? It's like, yeah, really, you could do that. And the whole society around you has labored for really thousands of years to provide every single one of you with this spectacular opportunity that you have while you're undergraduates and graduate students here, mm-hmm. man. Everyone's just praying that you would come here and manifest everything that you could manifest. And that's what you should be doing instead of waving placards and complaining about how you're oppressed, for God's sake. You see these Yale students complaining about their oppression. It just leaves me aghast. Mm. It's like, well, we're against the ruling class. It's like, no, 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 you're baby ruling class members. You're young. The only reason you're not rich is because you're young. You know, that's the best. Really, that's the. If you look at the 1%, even the dreaded 1%, you know, most of those people are old. Why? Well, when you progress through life, if you're reasonably successful, you trade in your promising youth for your wealthy old age. But you're still bloody old. Would you trade it? Would you trade your youth for that? Like, if you factor age out of the economic equation, things look a lot different. Well, of course older people have more money. If they have any sense, they've been collecting it for their whole life. Is that somehow unfair? It's not unfair unless you want to be poverty-stricken when you're 70. And you don't want to be poverty-stricken when you're 70. So I just don't understand what's happened to the universities. I can't mm-hmm. believe that you're not told when you come the first day, look, man, you're here on a heroic mission. You're going to take your capacity to articulate yourself to levels that are undreamed of. You're going to come out of here unstoppable. You're going to be able to do anything you want.
I want to be able to go into this in depth, but also in about 10 minutes from now, I'm going to have my guest. I would recite something from the Irish philosopher and playwright George Bernard Shaw. He said, "The worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. That's the essence of inhumanity. When we no longer consider others essential to life, then we dismiss them. We can do it by their race, their culture, their religion, their ethnicity, their income status, social status, educational status. We have many different ways of prejudicing ourselves against others. And I believe, as an academic, as someone who's been a teacher in colleges for decades, that my responsibility is to help those who are there to be more critical in their thought, to be able to study on both sides of an issue, learn the strength and weaknesses of different philosophies, and therefore be able to think to yourself, which of these two sides, if either, represent a truth that I want to then articulate to others. Think of all the good doctors and nurses, dietitians, nutritionists, who truly believe in helping other people. They are humane. They are kind. They each have their own personality. But think what happens when they only took that amount of education that was given to them to teach to the test. Regurgitate what you've been taught as if what you were taught was true, instead of challenging it and doing your own research. And then they come out, they've been rewarded with a degree, there's a job waiting for them. But what if, in their best interest of honoring themselves, they never honored the truth because they never sought it? They never went that extra step, that extra burden that he's discussing, that extra responsibility, not just to accept what we've been taught in a class as if it were infallible, but to find its weaknesses, to deconstruct it. I remember once I, at the Institute of Applied Biology, when I had just made tenure as a research fellow, and I had a major discovery. And at the monthly meeting of all the different departments, I made my presentation, and there was just quiet at the table. That was the one where I found that you did not have to consume any animal proteins whatsoever to get all your amino acids that are essential to good health. And therefore, we could save our health. We could save the planet. We could help people in other countries grow crops based upon the high quality of their amino acid intake. And therefore, I had a formula of which crops you would grow together and consume together, including even those that could grow more arid areas versus more wet areas. And I even had some from the UN who came to meet with me, and I gave them 5,000 combinations that they could take back to Africa and have people grow these to eat and save people from malnutrition, kwashiorkor, marasmus. So anyhow, it was a major thing when you consider you're saying we don't need the dairy industry, the meat industry, the egg industry, the fish industry. We don't need any of this in our lives. Think the money you're saving, the environment you're saving, the carbon footprint, and physical health and animal suffering. And there was this quiet. And this very wise man who was the director of the Institute said, "Okay, Gary, you've made your presentation. You've given us all your report. Now go disprove yourself." I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you've made it clear that you have a discovery. Show us where you're wrong. Show us where you're inaccurate, where you're not objective." Well, that was a head-turner, so I went back upstairs, and for 2 months, I did everything I could to be on the other side of that argument and disprove myself, find the weaknesses, find the flaws, find that one point that was wrong, and I couldn't. So I asked Dr. Berman and others to find where I was wrong. And after another 2 months, they couldn't. So it took almost 4 months, and I went back. I said, "Sir, I cannot find where I'm wrong." And he said, well, we've already looked at your work, and we tried to find you were wrong, and we couldn't. Therefore, now feel comfortable, at least, that at this moment in time, you've contributed something of value to science. And I took that principle from that moment on in everything I do. Every documentary, every article, every book, every investigative report, I send out not to friends but to critics saying, tear to pieces, show where I'm wrong. Now, what would happen if you as a student or a learner in anything you're doing chose not just to accept what was being taught to you in the moment you were in, but also how you could take it to another level, how you could take it to a level where you could be right about it because you've challenged yourself, you've put yourself through an acid test. You didn't take the lazy, easy road. And so you have something of substance, something of universal truth. And is it a universal truth that you're learning at Harvard or Yale or Princeton? He said, you know, you're already at the top of the world. Well, in the illusion that an institution by in and of its own moniker, its name, gives you a preferential treatment, and the world does as well, he is correct. I feel it's wrong because the quality of education at a college, at a state public educational institution, is equal in the terms of what is necessary in order to graduate and in the accreditation as one of the Ivy League named schools. So we frequently hide behind the pretense that who we associate it with, the companies we work for, the educational institutions we attend, make us special. It does not. I believe he is absolutely correct that you shouldn't waste yourself in college. Better, as he said, to learn a trade than to learn something that's not going to prepare you for critical thinking. Also, I believe that I would challenge him in a respectful manner, that you could be a crypto-fascist and be highly articulate. Narcissists tend to be articulate. But a narcissist sees everything being about themselves and not anyone else. They personalize everything. And that's why when you have a narcissist in your life, you've got a problem. But what if you have a whole school of narcissist students? He did not mention that. What if your teachers are narcissists? What if the school culture is narcissistic? Then you're going to end up not being able to articulate universal truths, but only personal truths. And if a personal truth is, I'll sell you a chemotherapy because I'm making a lot of money from it. But if you die from the chemotherapy, that's just the consequence of the paradigm I'm part of. That's where we must look at universal truths, not just individual truths. More on this on an upcoming program. And my next commentary will be on transhumanism, a final corporate takeover of humanity. It's not the future, by the way. It's here now. You're just not seeing or hearing about it. But I've been able to discover where it's going on and how transhumanism is, I won't go into it, but it's one of those things that for the average person, you'll never be able to afford it. For those who can afford it, they're lining up for it. Wow. How unfortunate that is. More on that coming up. Now we're just going to take a few minutes, and we're going to go over, and because we have coming up the second and third week of April, we have a retreat, the only one doing this year. And it's going to be a wonderful retreat. One of the most beautiful areas. It'll be in probably the 80s. Everything's going to be blooming, flowers, aromatic flowers, thousands of them. There's a wonderful, beautiful lake. There's swans. The food is gourmet and vegan. But also I'm doing something different with this retreat that I've never done at 300 retreats over the last 40 years. I'm inviting people who have remarkable minds to come and also do lecturing. And this time it's Dr. Gabriel Cousins, probably one of the best five holistic physicians in the world. And he'll be doing meditations and yoga. He is a phenomenal human being. And it's a gift for him to be able to take time out of his busy schedule to come. But he wants to do it. Also, Dr. Cheryl Salmon on women's health issues will be there. That's just two of the different ones, plus Dr. Lynn Saputo. So we have some outstanding people coming. people be able to get counseling, people be able to motivate themselves, as much quiet as they can handle, they're going to get. Insightful lectures, all of our lectures in the Socrates Gardens, beautiful marble plaza, these are deep thinking, critical thinking, look at life as it is and figure it out. I can assure you this, the students at Harvard or Yale will not have had the insightful lectures that the people coming are going to get. There's a lot of joy, laughter, happiness involved in this whole process because the staff have been selected based upon their harmonizing belief that if we have a gift, we give a gift. They are all successful in their own right. So we have a spectacular staff. And I'm just going to quickly say hello to Jerry Baker because she was at our last retreat. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
I'm always excellent.
That's right. Happy Valentine's.
If I was any better... Good. Jerry, tell us about your last experience at the retreat.
Okay. First of all, I have to thank Gary and Gary Knoll and name just a few of his most outstanding staff and cadre of stellar support personnel. Thank you, Lou Ann Panacey and Barbara Duggan and Floyd Lindsay and John Q and David. And let me tell you something. Gary represents all that is truly good and charitable and human life. And I have to tell you that he just offers his abundance and his plenty, his mercy and justice and wisdom and wealth and good fortune. And we are just recipients of that. And I am so very thankful. Now, I have a mother who's 103 years old in a nursing home. And I had planned to attend the retreat, not because I was sick or sickly or depressed. I have a debt of love and responsibility for all that my mom and my father have done for me. However, I had to take a moment. I had to step off and return to Gary's retreat again to enhance my own health. The retreat allowed me to harness my energies and my well-being and return to New York in a very happy state of mind, body, and spirit. I went to the retreat with excitement for yet another opportunity to step off and recharge my life's energies and batteries. And I want to tell you, I was picked up at the airport from the beginning by a wonderful man and a knowledgeable man who shared some information with me that has had some far-reaching ramifications for my family today. And I just want to tell you how thankful I am to him, Gary. When I got there, I stayed at a cottage, and the bucolic environment added to my rapture. I was picked up every morning and taken to Gary's ranch. The staff person, Floyd, was so pleasant. It was just a joy to be up and awaiting the ride with him and some of the other guests. Once at the ranch, we hydrated ourselves in participation for the four-mile walk. Upon our return from the invigorating experience with John Q, we were served delicious smoothies. And then after that, we were able to participate in creative and scripted events and activities. And there are so many activities to participate in, including yoga, the art classes, the writing, the meditation, and lectures on horticulture, cooking. And we were able to participate in the water therapy, exercises in a large gym. And every night, Gary gave us another signature lecture or prize-winning documentary. I mean, what's not to love with this? The bucolic environment also is complemented and rich with an array of animals who are domesticated and are just beautiful to watch. And it only adds to the majestic ambience of the ranch. There were peacocks and donkeys and guinea hens, eagles and hawks. I mean, things that we just don't get a chance to see here in New York. And the organic food that we were served by gourmet chefs, and we were served by and waited on by a group of kindred-spirited people. It was just a magnificent experience. And I recommend this experience to everyone and anyone who wants to relax and reflect and re-energize. You get your spirit, your health, and your goals in place. And I'd certainly return to New York Recharge to continue my advocacy and my activism for my mother in the nursing home institution and to carry on the other work that I'm doing. And, Gary, I want to thank you again
Good.
For being my Bushido warrior.
All right. Well, thank you, Jerry. I look forward to seeing you down there in April. All the best to you. And Luann, for people who would like to join us, would you give your number, please?
Surely. It's 903-881-7008. Again, that's 903-881-7008. Give me a call. I interview everyone to make sure it's the right event for you.
And we got to remember, frequently people think that they don't deserve health, don't deserve de-stressing, don't deserve a beautiful environment. They're still juggling responsibilities every day. It's time to give yourself that break. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Let's go over now and say hello to my guest who is standing by. She is today in Paris. She is Vanessa Beely, B-E-E-L-E-Y. She is a British investigative journalist who has focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Syria and Gaza and Yemen. She's an associate editor of 21st Century Wire and was a member of a peace-finding mission to Syria and organized by the U.S. Peace Council. Vanessa was in Aleppo during and after its liberation, after the city had been captured by being under siege for over 5 years by Western-backed Salafist terror organizations last year. And she is credited with having exposed the fraud behind the faux charitable volunteer organization, the Syrian Civil Defense Group, or better known as the White Hats, which was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. But so was Henry Kissinger's, and so that shouldn't surprise people. And she's also a contributing writer for the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine. Nice to have you with us today, Vanessa.
Hi, thanks. Good to be back on. It's been a while.
Yes. Vanessa, just recently, last week, the United States killed 200 Syrian and Russians. It's a sovereign country. We were not invited. But now Trump insists that we stay there permanently, and the UN is not showing its outrage. So I'd like you to take us through what's wrong with our approach to Syria, what's happening in Syria, especially as Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the entire, let's say, the neoliberal agenda being implemented, Assad should have been gone. But he's still there. So tell us what the people of Syria actually feel about Assad, how he's dealing with the fact that he has survived and what he's doing to rebuild his country. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I mean, that's quite a big question. I mean, the first question, coming back to the alleged bombing of the Russian soldiers, I don't think that has been fully confirmed. However, America, obviously, in September 2016, did criminally and deliberately, as part of the coalition, bomb Syrian Arab Army soldiers defending Deir ez-Zor from ISIS, and at that point allowed ISIS to move forward and take strategic positions that put the civilians that were besieged in Deir ez-Zor in danger and obviously also killed. I think it was over 70 Syrian Arab Army soldiers defending their own people in their own country against U.S. financed and armed terrorism. And that does include ISIS, as we've seen numerous occasions. The U.S. has colluded with ISIS. It has airlifted them to safety. It has basically worked in collaboration with all terrorist groups inside Syria. And, you know, that point needs to be made very clearly. There is no great delineation between ISIS, Nusra Front, Nordan Zinkiar al-Sham, and all the various rebranded, relabeled terrorist factions that are destroying Syrian infrastructure and on a daily basis committing atrocities against the Syrian people. Coming back to the 200 Russians, as I said, I don't think that that figure has been confirmed. However, the U.S. did attack what were effectively Syrian tribal forces defending, even now, Deir ez-Zor against ISIS factions that are still sort of embedded in that area. And there is a report out today that the Pentagon again has confirmed that it destroyed, as they describe it, a pro-government tank. It's not a pro-government tank. It's a Syrian Arab Army tank. And the Syrian Arab Army, as any national conscript army, is the Syrian people. I don't think the Americans would be very pleased if we described the American army as Trump's army, for example, just to kind of really correct that little misuse of lexicon by Western media, for example. But moving on, I mean, I was watching an interview yesterday with people who had been attacked by the terrorist factions, financed and armed by the U.S. coalition, who are embedded in the eastern suburbs of Damascus. So you're hearing right now about chemical weapon attacks in eastern Ghouta. You're hearing about the airstrikes in eastern Ghouta, just as you heard about that as the Syrian Arab Army were liberating civilians in East Aleppo from 4.5 years of U.S.-financed terrorist occupation. What is actually happening is that those terrorist factions in eastern Ghouta, I've just come back from Damascus, from Syria, where I was there for about 5 weeks during the end of December and through into January. I was at one point about 100 meters away from the front lines of eastern Ghouta, and I can categorically tell you that the Syrian government, the Russian humanitarian organizations, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, and a number of other Syrian civil society organizations are effectively evacuating civilians from that area as safely as they possibly can through negotiations with the terrorist factions, through convoys going in with the protection of the Arab Red Crescent. And they are evacuating both civilians, people who need medical care, even terrorists who have accepted amnesty are being brought out. And humanitarian supplies are going in on a regular basis. What is happening is those terrorist factions, just as they did in East Aleppo, just as they did in Madaya, are taking in those humanitarian supplies, and they are depriving the civilians who are living under their occupation of food, of medical supply, and of care. We need to remember that those same terrorists, Jaish al-Islam, put civilians in cages as human shields. So these are not sort of, you know, some friendly opposition forces or some freedom bringing, in inverted commas, rebels. These are vicious, brutal terrorists who are not only besieging and imprisoning the civilians in the areas they are occupying, but on a daily basis, they are raining mortars and missiles down into the old city of Damascus. I was there on a number of occasions. I was just left Damascus the day that 9 people were killed, the majority of them school children. One girl has had her leg amputated below the knee. A 3-year-old child was killed in that attack. And this is never spoken about by the Western corporate media because it doesn't serve the regime change narrative. So effectively what you're seeing, the reason that President Assad is still there is because this isn't about President Assad. Like, you know, this is the monolithic argument that is created by the corporate media in the West in line with their government's foreign policy, which is effectively regime change and destabilization of an independent sovereign nation again. So the reason that we see President Assad there is, as I said, because this isn't about President Assad. It's about the Syrian people defending their secular way of life, defending their pluralism, defending their multiculturalism, and refusing to allow the U.S. coalition to dictate that they end up with a Muslim Brotherhood or moderate extremist Islamic political regime that will work in compliance with the United States and its client states in the region, Saudi Arabia and Israel. So the reason President Assad is there is because the Syrian state and the Syrian army are defending their people against a fate which would be probably one of the worst massacres we would ever witness were the Syrian army and its allies to lose this military campaign.
I appreciate the overview. Thank you. Give us your insight into the success of Russia versus the United States claiming success against ISIS in Syria.
Well, that's an easy one. Look, the United States is a rogue state. It's acting illegally. It's violating international law. It should not be inside Syria. It is committing a supreme act of aggression by bombing the national forces in its own country that are defending its own people against the terrorist factions that have been embedded into that country by the U.S. and its allies. And, you know, if we're talking about the SDF here, I mean, the U.S. claims to be defending the SDF, but effectively the SDF is just another moniker for a U.S. proxy inside Syria that is trying to annex Syrian territory and to convert it into another state within a state, i.e. Kurdistan. Now, I also have to say here that those separatist Kurds that are being power multiplied by the United States are in the minority. The majority of the Kurdish sects and factions inside Syria are actually supporting the Syrian government. In Afrin right now, to the northwest, where Turkey is now hammering that area, because, of course, it wants to also annex a part of Syria. We're seeing the Kurdish factions there actually asking the Syrian Arab army for help and assistance. So effectively, the United States is yet again the primary player in what is effectively a destructive force. That Russia has been invited in by the elected government inside Syria, and it is acting entirely within international law in its alliance with Syria and with the other allies of Syria who are battling this terrorist threat. So I think what we're seeing is, if you like, for me, Syria has exposed the reality of the world we live in. And the reality is that we have the United States, which is effectively this empire that has governed the world through force. And that is now being exposed as being a dishonest international law broker. It is breaking international law. And without international law and without the supremacy of law, none of us in this world have any security. So basically, the United States is destroying world security. Russia, on the other hand, I'm not saying it's not a pragmatic player in this and that it doesn't have its own interests, but regardless of that, it is upholding international law. And it is effectively proving itself to be an honest international broker, very different. So what we're seeing is a shift, it's a paradigm shift in the global power balance. And we're seeing now Russia, for example, has just brokered the talks in Sochi. It is now the primary negotiator with Israel. I mean, even after the recent shooting down of the Israeli jet by the Syrian forces, and then Israel threatening to target various areas inside Syria, we've not seen the United States step in. We've seen Russia step in. So this, you know, this is what Syria has done is really shifted global balance. And from my perspective, having seen the destruction that the United States has brought to bear upon the world generally, it's not a bad thing.
A final question. When you look at Syria today, what is the mood of the people? And are people coming back? We had millions of Syrians seek refuge in other countries, and there was massive destruction. Do you see any rebuilding? Do you see any normalizing of people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, this is the one extraordinary thing about the Syrian people. I mean, I went back to Aleppo in the last few weeks. And of course, it's just over a year since its liberation in December 2016. And what was extraordinary was every street you go to in East Aleppo, for example, you will see cottage industry coming back to life. And you will see people on the pavements with their welders trying to basically rebuild their homes. The small enterprises, there's a whole street, for example, where the textile factories that were either destroyed or the people who were administrating those factories were driven out by ISIS and then by Nusra Front. They're all coming back and they're all rebuilding and the machines are up and running again and they're producing textiles and fabrics again. It's quite extraordinary how once this terrorist cancer is removed, as it is extracted from areas, how quickly the people are coming back. I think over 800,000 people have come back, but primarily to Aleppo since the liberation. And that's an extraordinary figure, and it's a figure that is simply not being talked about in mainstream media because, of course, they want to maintain this narrative that the Syrian government and the Syrian army are attacking their own people. But that's a very important point that I want to make. When I was in Syria this time, I spent quite a lot of time in an area close to Idlib, in Hama, in Salamiye, in various villages around there that are totally surrounded on four sides by terrorist factions, including ISIS and including Nusra Front. When I spoke to the families in those villages, and I interviewed many of them, what they told me and what I picked up from those conversations, what I already knew, to be honest, is that every single family in Syria has somebody, a relative, a son, a father, a daughter, a husband, fighting in the Syrian Arab army. So the one message that I really want to get out to your listeners is please don't imagine that the Syrian army is some sort of disembodied entity that is totally connected to the presidency or to the government. The Syrian Arab army belongs to the people and the people belong to the army. And that is the one message that all of these families who've lost their children fighting to protect them in Syria against the terrorism that is being sent to them by our governments. These people are heroes. These people are I can't even describe the sacrifices they're making. With the sanctions, so they're fighting under crippling sanctions, which means that a lot of their equipment is way outdated compared to the terrorist factions who are being regularly supplied and equipped, again by our governments. And you know, this is just such an important message to get out there. Stop allowing the media, the NATO-aligned NGOs, stop allowing them to demonize the Syrian Arab army. This is an army exactly the same as the American army, as the British army, who are defending their people against foreign invaders in their country. And they should be honored for doing that, not demonized and maligned and dehumanized, actually, because when the Syrian Arab army soldiers are murdered by the United States coalition, we don't see any mourning. We don't see any grieving for them. And yet these people are defending civilians against terrorism. You know, those same terrorists that are committing heinous acts against civilians in the UK, in Paris, in Brussels.
Message understood. Thank you very much, Vanessa. We look forward to another conversation in the near future.
Thank you so much.
Vanessa Bealey from Paris. She was there. She is one of the few journalists willing to tell us the truth versus the unfortunate type of journalists we have at the New York Times, Washington Post, and CNN, and even on some of Pacifica's stations. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Tonight I'm learning. Take a shower.